Welcome to Combox. I'm Jared Kimber. We're here for the Wagon Wheel Show, which is the podcast that answers your questions on cricket. And the best way to do it, if you're watching live on YouTube, is to send a super chat through. But if you support us on Patreon, like many, many incredible, incredibly attractive, intelligent cricket fans do, you can ask a question over there, like Cam has. It's Good Areas Podcast, you can find it. And Cam has asked, Annabelle Sutherland is a gun in white ball formats, but it's probably even better with the red or pink ball. Not really sure what my question is, but I feel like we're going to miss out on seeing all-time great tests due to how little test women play. I guess the same could be said about Perry, but Sutherland looks even better with the ball. I don't know if I'd have Sutherland ahead of Perry with the ball. Not early Perry anyway, maybe later, older Perry, but Sutherland's like a yard and a half slower, right? There's a big difference there. But yeah, I think that's the case. I would, you know, you look at some of these women, you look at Mitali Raj, you know, like she could have been the best test player in the world, right? And yet she just doesn't play it all that much. I don't think we've had a woman play 20 tests since Charlotte Edwards, I want to say. I think she's on her own. I don't think there's that many as well. So look, it's a very different kind of game. Who knows what the future of women's cricket will be in many different ways, but I like that we have tests, and obviously I'm a little bit upset that, you know, New Zealand still haven't sort of joined this and everything else. But other than that, there is no, you know, there is no real issue there. So, you know, we should be playing more women's tests, but I just don't know how we ever will. So maybe you could make this argument, Cam, really from 1990 onwards, right? Is the most tests a woman's ever played, is it 27 or 35? Like, it's nothing. So it's been here for a while and ain't going nowhere, I suppose is the best way of putting it. Gaji says, will Indian men players ever be allowed to play SA20 or 100 if they don't play in the national team? But they still play in the IPL. Honestly, I believe that I'd be shocked if all these owners are buying all these teams around the world and they're not play, and their plan is not to play Indian players one day. I just, there's too much money being spent on some of these teams. So I can't imagine that is the case. So I'd be absolutely shocked if it is. Now, how this works in the future, I know that obviously some players want to play as retired players. You might also get maybe some younger players coming through, but I think one day, the IPL is just going to be so much stronger than any other league that until it gets to like 6 or 8 months, I can't imagine we'll ever be in a situation where you wouldn't like just put some of your players in the other leagues. Like, I get the original idea and it's kind of already worked, but like if you put like 5 or 10 Indian players in the SA20, it doesn't mean that the SA20 is anywhere near the level of the IPL suddenly, right? Like, it's still very different. So I do think there is something along those lines that will happen eventually, but exactly how it breaks and when it breaks, I don't know. Ali says, which league has the best scouting networks, PSL, SA20 or CPL, considering these countries tend to not to catch all the good players in their systems? It's very hard to be a talented West Indian player and not be on the radar just because there are so few cricketers. I'm not saying it's impossible and no one's ever been missed out, but it's actually, these are small islands. You know, there's probably the biggest issue with CPL, but just in West Indies cricket in general is maybe some of the very small islands sometimes keep people get missed out. But then you've got the universities thing, and then the islands combine. And even if you're from a small island, you would, you know, play with the Windward Islands or whatever that may be. There's a couple other versions of that as well. South Africa, I think South Africa's big problem with missing talent isn't once it gets to a level where you can pick it. Their big problem with missing talent is more to do with the fact that you almost have to go to a public school a private school at one stage in order to play SA20 or for South Africa. And that's just, you'll never be able to convince me that there isn't loads of talent in state schools that is just, you know, is being missed. I'm 100% sure that that is the case. And then you've got the PSL. The PSL's big issue is that there are lots of people playing really high level cricket in Pakistan who are not playing with cricket balls or are not playing in leagues that anyone is having a look at. And it's a bigger, way bigger than the other two, areas. It's more complicated and it doesn't have a great professional setup as we've seen by the nonsense they've done recently. So, I mean, PSL would be missing talent on such a comical level. But as far as the franchises, you really just have to be richer, right? I came up with something for the CPL, which I thought was, you know, a way of scouting cricket that it wouldn't actually cost you all that much money. It would have cost them about $60,000 a year. And I thought from that, we would have had the best young pipeline in the CPL coming through. And the owner didn't want to pay it. It's not that hard to set up really good scouting networks in somewhere like the West Indies and South Africa. It's probably a little bit harder in Pakistan, but there are ways to do it. You just have to actually set up a scouting network, right? You can't just allow for former players and current players and coaches to see things. You actually need someone to use the shoe leather and also use, we have two different versions of scouts now. We have the shoe leather guys. The guys are going out there finding people that there's not even a camera on. And then we have the ability to use all this footage of even club cricketers to see if there's anyone who's interested. Josh says, should New Zealand be considering Seifert and Finauan as aggressive options for the 2027 World Cup? Conway, Ratchin, Kane, Mitchell and Phillips are likely better options. Latham has a good Ford trophy too. I'd have to have a look at their ODI records a little bit more. Finauan doesn't instantly come to my mind as someone who could play ODI cricket. Just because he's almost set up almost entirely for tests. Seifert probably makes a little bit more sense, but I'd have to go through their records. I do think that, you know, Ratchin's obviously had some great stuff and Darryl Mitchell's been fantastic. And Phillips now weirdly seems more like an ODI batter than a T20 batter, which I would never have said a while back. But it's hard to keep up with the big hitting teams if everyone is quite one-paced. And I think there is an element with sort of Conway, Kane, Mitchell, Latham, that you can be a little bit one-paced at times. So, you know, jazzing that up or letting some people go is probably the better option. Ajit says, I don't normally like to compare men's and women's cricket because of the various variables. There are various variables. But I did have the thought the other day, is there a different way Australian women handle Annabelle Sutherland compared to Australia handling Cam Green? On paper, they're supposed to be similar players, but I know that Green had a very long injury not long ago. But even so, the return on investment on Green seems underwhelming compared to Sutherland and across all formats. Okay, so one of your various variables actually is playing up here, Ajit, and it's that women mature quicker than men. So I always use women's tennis as the perfect example of this, right? But you see it right across all women's sports, and you don't even have to be following women's sports to be able to pick this up. It's quite clear that this is a thing that it is happening and has happened for a very, very long time, right? And so generally with men's all-rounders, we see their development in the back end of their career a lot more. So that 26, 28 period. We talk about it on this channel all the time, you know, Vettori and Jadeja and Imran Khan, Sobers. A lot of these guys develop at 25, 26, 27, especially with their second skill, right? And I think what you're seeing with Sutherland is she actually came in as a frontline bowler, right? So when I first watched her for the Renegades, when she must have been very, very young, she was playing as a frontline bowler. So her bowling skill was good enough for her to play as their, at least in their top five bowlers, and give it a little bit of batting at that point. Over time, she's probably become, I mean, I don't even know what you would say of her anymore, but she's probably more of a, I think a higher upside is probably with her batting into the future. Although, who knows, the way she's developing, she can be anything. But I would still think that her curve for an all-rounder, and if you look at other great women all-rounders, their curves start a lot earlier with their second skill than we see with the men, right? So I don't actually think they're comparable in that kind of way. And also the other thing we see that women all-rounders seem to be a lot easier to find, right? And have a much bigger impact than we've had with men. As in Marizanne Kapp, Elise Perry, Nat Siva-Brunt, Sanamir. You could go through like a bunch of these different players who are genuine top four batting prospects at times and also top four bowling prospects at times, or at worst, the fifth bowler. We don't get that many in cricket, in men's cricket, in the same way. So there still seems to be, you know, and that's just because there aren't enough women playing cricket. And one day we will have more specialists in women's cricket going ahead. Average Joe says, why do cricket broadcasts from grounds outside Asia often look clearer? Is it camera technology, lighting, air quality? I sometimes feel I can tell an India versus Australian broadcast from just a few frames. So there was a lot of it is that, I mean, the cameras used in cricket are not that great. And part of the reason is that in order to get a really, really crisp frame in cricket, you need to spend an awful lot of money. But someone did a piece on this recently about how India, the cameras used in India, Pakistan, Sri Lanka just aren't as high quality as other places. I think air quality has to play a part. I remember I was talking to Deepak about this one day, and Deepak was saying, oh, but the air quality in that city is actually really good compared to everywhere else. And I looked up, the air quality in London that day was like 0.1%. And that city he was looking at was like 38 or 38.9 and AQI or whatever it is. And I was like, that's still a massive difference, right? So I do think air quality plays a part. If you go back and you always watch cricket, though, I always felt like it was there, right? If you go back to, like, the old West Indies footage always looked different than South African footage. And so I do think that just camera technology and what you choose to broadcast it on, I would assume most of them would be on PAL, but maybe there would be some NTSC or whatever it's called, the other one, the American one, out there as well. Camera quality plays a part. Air pollution plays a part. So I think there's quite a few things. I don't think lighting plays a part, I would assume, because there are some Asian grounds that have very similar lighting to other non-Asian grounds. But maybe, you know, I think the way that the sun looks, I always feel like, you can kind of, Australia just has a different kind of brightness to its sun than some of the other hot countries. But a lot of it is also maybe grading is another one. Hertz says, I was told you have a great cricket IQ. I'm not sure that's true, but I'm Divam Sube. My batting helps my team massively, but I also want to improve my bowling and become a reliable six bowling option. I've tried to increase my pace without success. What else should I focus on? And how can I reduce my turning radius? That one I can't help him with. But I think the biggest issue with Shivam Dubey at the moment is he's not bowling enough, right? And he needs to be bowling long, long spells to better understand his bowling in other formats of cricket. I don't see why he can't be like Marcus Stoinis. And I'm trying to think of someone else. I was going to say Dan Christian. Dan Christian's a better bowler. But Marcus Stoinis, in that Marcus Stoinis really has two ways of bowling for you. He can either swing it around a little bit in conditions that help, or he can whack it into the surface. And I kind of feel that if you're that kind of sixth bowler, that's all you want to be, right? Is like, you look at someone like Jimmy Neesham, who's a little bit more talented than Shivam Dubey, but at one stage, Jimmy Neesham had the highest economy ever in the power play, which he was, you know, rap that I was mentioning. And he's certainly a batting all-rounder, not a bowling all-rounder. And I think that Jimmy Neesham is really good at understanding how to bowl on the wickets that suit him, right? And so he gets good results on those wickets. And I think with Shivam Dubey, what we have at the moment is it's very rare that he's in a situation where he's exploiting a wicket that even is in his favor. And I think that's what he has to learn, because he knows there's going to be lots of wickets that are not going to help the kind of bowler he is, right? So he has to minimize the damage on the bad wickets. It might be bouncers. It might be wide Yorkers, right? It might be, you know, he might have to try the knuckleball or whatever it may be. But he also has to get better at exploiting the wickets that are in his favor. And I think it's the combination of those two things that sometimes causes an issue for his bowling. Look, he's not deadly accurate. The ball doesn't always come out of his hand perfectly. That's okay, but you can mitigate that by having other sort of go-tos on the bad days. And I'm not sure he has those. Adityan says, now that Abhishek scored the final, maybe we can revisit his form dip without all the noise. Is it a lot easier to talk about anchors being found out if there is a pattern in the way he or she is dismissed? But how do you differentiate between Abhishek being found out versus the natural inconsistency that comes with someone as high intent? So the first thing I would say there, Adityan, is You cannot work out if someone's been found out over 8 games, 6 games, or whatever it was. So I wouldn't even, they would have to go out exactly the same way almost every time. And they would also have to have not been hospitalized, right? I've talked about this so much, but the flow of your bat can be changed by so many micro things. And I just think having something to, was it his gut? He was, you know, having something to do with his stomach or his whatever it was that made him go into hospital means that there is probably an issue there. So my first thing would be, I'm not particularly worried about that. The second one you talk about, his dismissal patterns of off spin and slashing balls well outside off stump. He was doing that beforehand though, right? So how many times have I seen him go out to either off spin or slashing out wide ones? Pretty regularly, right? So again, is it like, it would be different if I'm trying to think of like the Bubba Azam one where he never really went out LBW before and he changes his technique and suddenly he's going out LBW a lot, right? I'm much more concerned about that than I would be someone who was already doing really good at something and is taking risks and is suddenly being dismissed by them. So I just think that we still don't understand attacking cricket. Well, I say we, the cricket fans in general, don't still understand attacking cricket the way that I think it should be. And because of that, we get ourselves into a position where we're always looking for it to fail, right? And I felt this. This is not a new thing. I felt this with Gilchrist. I felt this with Sehwag. I felt this with everyone. I had friends who peak Gilchrist era were saying to me, he's going to end up averaging 30 in Test cricket. And I went, mathematically, that's not even possible. He would be dropped from the team if he went on a run that bad for a long period of time, right? But you can go back to Viv on this as well. People are always looking for a reason why that thing can't work. And I'm like, well, look, I get it, but he's also, once you've been doing it for 2 or 3 years, the chances are that it won't disappear. You might get, who would I put in this? Harry Brook, Kevin Peterson, you might get with players like them that it doesn't always have this huge average and it comes down to settle in a more normal place. But you can have that with a defensive batter. You can have that with a normal strike rotating batter, right? But no one seems to ever look for it with those things. They only ever seem to look for it with the big attacking batters. And that's because they don't kind of understand what they're doing in the first place. Cricket boards actually make watching their games almost impossible. I spend almost as much time trying to find where I can view it as I do actually following the action. That is why I use NordVPN. They let me find all the cricket I want to watch while protecting me from the nasty side of the internet. Nord will free your cricket matches. Grab your exclusive NordVPN deal by going to nordvpn.com/goodareas to get a huge discount off your NordVPN plan plus 4 additional months on top. It's completely risk-free with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. Watch every match with NordVPN. James says, any insight into what's going on with Pakistan dropping their 2 best ODI batters because of T24? I mean, I don't have any insights on it. It's what's happening to Pakistan cricket, and we've seen it with, Sri Lanka and Bangladesh at times. We've seen it with lots of teams traditionally. Is what happens when you're not professional and you don't know how to run a sport. And I think a lot of, decisions are made at times based on the wrong things. I just don't think it's a particularly well-run organization and, glad I don't work in it. Really. Mob says, why is Team India scared of black soil? I don't think they are. I think the whole black soil, red soil, by the way, is it's a fascinating one because black soil and red soil also can be very different in different parts of India. If you go back and you look at some of those traditional red soil wickets back in the old days, they were the ones that were spinning sideways and weren't always bouncing. Like, it's not always a steady all the way through. I'd be interested to know in why. I think having a mix of red and black is probably the way forward for, lots of different places. But I don't think India's scared of black soil. Reece says, are England a victim of their own one-day success since 2015? The fact of the matter is that they did very well to get the semis playing as badly as they did throughout the tournament. If this was England of 2013, outside the English media, most intelligent cricket people would accept England aren't as good as the other top three teams. No, I think the issue is that there's still a lot of talent there. And, you know, it's a frustrating thing. Look, they've made two World Cup semifinals. And in all honesty, like, I'm not sure how, because they haven't played particularly good cricket, and I'm not sure they put themselves together. I think the issue here is, Reece, that we have, what, since they won in 2022, it's kind of dropped off, and no one's exactly sure what has happened. Like, as in, it's not really retirements, it's not really people aging out, right? Like, there's Adil Rashid still playing, Jofra's still playing, Josh Butler in this tournament might be aging out, but he's still around. Phil Salt is fantastic. Will Jacks has come from nowhere. Player like Jamie Overton fulfills a very similar role than they've had before. Sam Curran's still around. Like, I think the issue is that they can't kind of get it together. I think you're being unfair to the critics, Reece, if you're just talking about this, because it's not just this. It's now been a bunch of tournaments in a row. What, four tournaments, I want to say, off the top of my head, where they've been disappointing, where they haven't really looked like they always know what they're doing. Like, at the moment, they don't seem to be batting the way that they used to, which is, you know, aiming for 30 runs, 40 runs ahead of par. They're not manufacturing wickets the way that they used to. It just looks like a bit of an awkward side at the moment. And I think it's fair to say that this was a team who changed white ball cricket probably forever, right? And yet has sort of dropped off a little bit. I don't think that's unfair at all to be critical of them, because that was part of how they got good at test cricket, was also doing that, right? Mob says, New Zealand as a country always pump out a reliable sturdy of pace options. A quote from every cricket pundit. I didn't get that memo in the last town hall. And why is running this show? I didn't get it. I'm not sure what that means. Is it more about the genius planning and rigorous requirements of New Zealand Academy level, or more about the 10 plus years of stable high performance chain of command through Shane Jurgensen and Jacob Oram, or something else? No, I think it's a combination of probably, if you look at 15 years, maybe you can stretch it to 20. I think what New Zealand created before was green wicket bowlers, right? And very, very, you know, one of the greatest of all time. And many other decent options, right? Even guys like Danny Morrison and Simon Dool, I think, in better bowling attacks with, you know, more around them. Chris Cairns, a really good all-rounder who can do that. Lots of those kinds of bowlers. What happened when they started to make their pitches a bit flatter and they probably started to use some more high-performance type of things, which Shane Jurgensen and Jacob Oram probably have, you know, part to play in, but I think it's a bit more than that. The Alan Donald was involved for a while as well, and Shane Bond has probably been involved at times too. I think what they really started to do is turn what they had originally done, which is creating very good first-class bowlers, and have started creating very good test bowlers. And that's a big step up, right? And a lot of that does help with the fact that they've started identifying people. I mean, Kyle Jameson and Neil Wagner would not have played for New Zealand at all in a previous era. Jameson would have been lost because of the fact that he was a batter, and maybe he comes back at like 30 as a bowler because he's a giant freak, but he wouldn't have been as skillful or as good as he is. And Neil Wagner would never have even moved to New Zealand because there was no professional system to move to, right? So I think a lot of it is that sort of professional side of things, but I think a lot of it is also changing the pitches and making them from traditional New Zealand wickets domestically to something more akin to test cricket. Mind you, test cricket became more like New Zealand traditional wickets, but it meant that the bowlers are a little bit better at multiple skills rather than just the new ball skills that they would have been good at traditionally. So I think there's probably, you know, a bunch of different changes that have come about that. I think if having a good, smart, professional structure allows you to keep bowlers. I wonder what Shane Bond would have been if he had been living under this structure rather than under the structure before. Sam says, when did you last read a novel and what was it? It's called, it's a novel about American football and nuclear war. American football, nuclear war novel. End Zone by Don DeLillo. Is that his name? Yeah, that was the last one I read. I really liked it. I made up quite a diverse, I like to make up like a reading list of books before I start a project. And I was starting the Coley book, and that was one of the ones I sort of came across. You know, my book is obviously nonfiction and that's fiction, but I was looking for something that I hadn't read before that was a fiction book about sport. It's a fascinating, it's written in such a interesting way. It's a really, really cool book, and I'd not heard of it before. I don't even know how I stumbled across it. But yeah, so I'm trying to think if I've read any other nonfiction books in that group. Oh yeah. I read that. This is all part of the Coley book. I read that. I read Ballard's Crash. And there was another novel I think I read in that period as well. But I read, you know, a lot of stuff about Indian mobile phones and random things like that. I read The Fighter, Friday Night Lights again, King of the World, and a few other books at the same time. So I must have read about 10 or 12 books in a few weeks at that point. PJ says, where did the different size of the ball come into play for both women and youth? And how did that come about? And how did they agree on one size and weight those two? I don't know the full amount of this, but they both happen for the exact same reason, PJ. And it's because women and kids really struggle to get a normal ball in their fingers. And so if you do that, you actually take away a lot of the basic skills that they can do. Like, you would almost stop anyone without freakishly long children's fingers from being a spinner, right? So a lot of young kids would struggle to bowl spin just because the ball is a lot bigger. I don't know exactly how they came across the size. I feel with women's cricket, it had something to do with the old English, the International Women's Organization, of which I've now completely forgotten the name of. But, you know, the original sort of governing body that ran women's cricket, I think there was an idea that this was perfect. But I would say it probably, if you're being really honest, it probably comes from the fact that women realized that they could use the youth size ball a lot easier. Right. And so there was already a ball there. So it's a bit the same with early women's cricket bats. Quite often they would use the Harrow bats, right? That was one of the reasons they struggled with the power. But that's at that stage, they weren't bats made for women. Eventually what they did was they made normal bats for women, but smaller for women. And I was kind of around in the UK when that first started, when companies first started making them. I think Hawke was one of the first companies that started doing that, you know, working directly with women's cricketers on what they needed. But they were still very similar in size to the sort of Harrow bats, but they are, you know, obviously a lot stronger and, you know, able to be used. So I would say that there's a link there, but I don't know exactly how that worked. Prudfi says, should we change the way we calculate batting averages for T20 specifically? I feel like there's not much of a value being not out for T20 games. There are advanced metrics, but I feel like something simpler like score per innings could be good. Score per innings doesn't really help you though, Prudfi, because that depends on where you come in. Someone who comes in to bat at number 6 or 7 compared to, like, I think the expected runs for an opener in most games is probably, what, 32, 33? And the expected runs for someone coming in at 6 or 7 is probably going to be, what, 17, 18? Maybe even less. It's probably less for number 7. So you would look like you're a worse player without you having done anything. You can't just take not outs away. But there are much better metrics to be able to do. You know, the best way, one of the ways that we look at it is we know what the expected score is. So if you come out to bat and your team is 12 for 2 and it's the four, and you're in the fifth over, right? We know what the expected total is for a batter in that situation of how many balls, right? That's what we're really looking at, right? What you are scoring more or less than expected in that situation. It's a much better way of doing it. We use average sometimes just because it's a shorthand, but we obviously use lots of other things. Sinoy says, Mo and Ali recently spoke about the potential of players in the 100 speaking up if there's a shadow ban on Pakistani players in the tournament. Do you think this shadow ban is likely? Yes. How can it be prevented? How do you see the ACB or players doing anything about this? You can't actually do anything about a shadow ban. And I mean, that it's this great term, is it? I'd love to go back. Does it come from social media? It feels like it comes from social media. There's not much you can do about it. As I've said before, I believe the first person to write down that there will be no Pakistani players in any league was someone from the ECB, right? And in my experience of having worked with these people, they don't tell you no. They just like, or they just say, oh, we don't want that guy, or we don't want those kinds of players, or however, and they don't write it down and they don't make it official. So it's really tough. There'll be players who will speak up about it. There'll be players who are upset about it. It's a real challenge for the ECB, and Cricket Australia will have the same challenge, right? And SA20 will have the same challenge. When it comes down to it, you can't say that you have an inclusive game and that you then don't want players from a certain country. I mean, if you're trying to sell it as an inclusive sport, and I think those places, and probably New Zealand, I know they're looking at making a new league, you're just in an awkward position, right? And you will get hit. But to be honest, in cricket, like, I feel like cricket is a sport of awkward positions, and we just continue with them over and over again, recycling them, maybe slightly changing them, but essentially we're an awkward sport. I once made a pair in a club game, which is almost impossible to do, but I have been obsessed with batting my entire life. And so I put that into my new book, The Art of Batting. Being that I'm not very good at that skill, I decided to talk to other people who were. So I hit up as many contacts as I could just to talk about batting. Rahul Dravid, Brian Lara, AB de Villiers, Kumar Sangakkara, Ross Taylor, Susie Bates, Nasser Hussain, Ian Chappell, and so many, many, many more. I wanted batters to talk about how they and their friends made runs, because that is the art of batting. Proofy says, what is a stat parameter you would like to measure in cricket that we can't currently? Yeah, reps on the ball probably would be, I think it's one of the most important things. I know that there's some American baseball companies who are trying to get into cricket. I talked to them like a decade ago and they were thinking about it. So I would assume now they're, and I know some of them have like cricket divisions. I don't know how serious they're taking it or anything, but they're putting money into it. So they want to do that. I think that's the best, that would be the best one. I just, when Dwayne Bravo or Lungi Ndidi or Jasprit Bumrah bowls a slow ball, I'd like to know exactly how many revs they're putting on it. Same with the spinners. And then also, what direction are the revs going in, right? So Nathan Lyon puts a lot of revs on the ball, but he doesn't get sideways spin. Ravi Jadeja puts a lot of revs on the ball, but he doesn't get overspin. I'd love to know what percent. So when you bowl a delivery, what percentage is side spin, angled spin, whatever, back spin, all these different things would be great. But for me, the big one is we don't know anything about fielding. I saw a bunch of people the other day saying how great a certain player had fielded, and I saw the footage back later, and I realized that actually that player had done great fielding, but they put themselves in the wrong position. So they'd saved the boundary, but they'd actually given up an extra run. I can't remember who it was, but it was one of the ones in the World Cup. And everyone was going on about this great bit of fielding, and I was like, no, it's cost his team a run because he took too long to react and was in the wrong position, right? We can actually work that out with data. We could start to get to a much better position. Like, there must be fielders, and I know there are, but there must be fielders who just stop the second being taken far more than others. So, I don't know, let's say you have a ball hit to wide long on. The expected runs on that ball is 1.4, right? And you've probably got fielders who are at 1.8, and you've probably got fielders who are at 1.1. I would love to know that, especially when it comes to wicket keeping as well. Ali says, how would you organize T20s in the Olympics? Best format for the tournament and how many teams should ideally be in the Olympics? Oh, how many teams is interesting. How many teams? I'm just trying to work out how many teams are in the basketball for the Olympics. That I think that always feels good. Is that 12? Yeah, 12. I think 12 makes the most sense in the Olympics. I'd like to do it by regions. I don't think you can do a qualifying event, so I think it has to be done by rankings, right? But I think there should be at least one team from every region. Not that that would be that big of a problem outside of, well, I suppose Guyana gets the South America one. But, good luck to Brazil and Argentina as well. But, yeah, I think as long as you've got most of the major regions covered and then you have the best 8 to 9 teams outside of that, I think that's probably the way that I would do it. And I can't remember how the group system works, but is it full groups of 3? I want to say in the Olympics for the basketball. I'm trying to remember back now. I think it's something like that anyway. Qualified. I can't find anything on here. Or is it 3 groups of 4 and then the best losers? Maybe the, yeah, it might be, actually it might be that. It might be 3 groups of 4. And so the top 2 teams go through and then the teams with the best point differential, maybe it's point differential, go through as well. Something like that. That's the way the basketball's on. But off the top of my head, that's what I'd be looking at early. Josh says, should New Zealand's difficulty with pace bowling this T20 be concerned for the upcoming massive year of tests and 2027 ODI World Cup? Well, 27 ODI World Cup's in South Africa, so I'm not worried about that. New Zealand tests in 2026. I know they play in England and they play in Australia. Did they play anywhere else? Because again, those are places where, look, Jacob Duffy didn't bowl very well in this tournament. And I think a lot of us had seen him bowl well before. A lot of seamers bowl very, very well. Not really his kind of seamers though, right? And he's not the only kind of seamer like him in his team. Matt Henry is another one. Rabah didn't bowl very well in this tournament. There were lots of decent seamers who didn't bowl very well, as well as obviously guys like Blessing and Gidi and Bumrah who bowled exceptionally. So I'm not sitting there going, well, this means definitely that there's a problem with New Zealand pace bowling. I don't know how good Duffy is, but if Duffy is as good as he has looked over the last couple of years, then Duffy and Matt Henry taking the new ball in the 2027 World Cup seems like a pretty good option. And Duffy and Henry, as again, in Test cricket, seems like a pretty good option. If they can get Jameson back in Test cricket as well. And Jameson in one-day cricket with a little bit of batting? I don't know his numbers, but I would think he should be okay in one-day cricket. So there's nothing in what I just saw then that makes me worry. Outside of just, maybe the form wasn't as crisp as you would want it to be. Ajit says, when it comes to winning an ODI or T20 World Cup, do you think South Africa and New Zealand need more arrogance? But in a good way, I mean. Almost every team we've seen win the World Cup has someone who will stand up and be in the face of the opposition. And in some iconic cases, even in the press conference. Maybe I just feel bad for them. I can't help but think nice guys finish last. No. I can't. I don't. Under. No. No. Don't think so. Just think they need to be better. I think there's reasons why they're both successful in World Cups and there's reasons why they're both not successful in World Cups. So I can understand why they get through the groups, but I can also see why they struggle at the other end. Average Joe says, are there regulations to stop jersey designs distracting batters? Well, clearly not, because Australia had a big red Westpac logo on the front, which you've mentioned as well, which I love. Who allowed that? I don't understand how the ICC is like, well, I'm sorry, you've got the wrong color shoelaces to a batter. And then they're just like, no, it's red, but it's not quite exactly the same red, is it? What? No, I don't think so. I haven't heard of anything. I don't even think, and I could be wrong in this. So bilaterals, obviously, I'm not even sure who would look at the shirts because you just turn up with them. I think in ICC tournaments, if I'm not mistaken, they have to go through the ICC, but I can't think of many, I've never heard of, put it this way, the ICC changing someone's shirt because of an issue like this. But I could be wrong. James says, MI London have signed Rashid Khan and Nicholas Puran, who both play for other franchises, for well below what they have gone for in the auction. Will these kinds of combined contracts across leagues and teams lead to a Perth Scorchers 2.0, where certain teams can just skirt around the salary caps and ruin balance? Yeah. Yeah. Look, the salary cap, it's funny. I'm going to do a whole video on this soon about the podcast. There's a podcast called Acquired, which is this whole business thing on the IPL. And they made a lot of really good points about the IPL. A lot of things I disagree with as well. Like, they wanted to stay with one game a night. And I was like, I just don't think that works. I think eventually people will just get bored, and people have already started to get bored, especially when you make the league longer. It's great. It's a great idea until you watch three bad games in a row and ratings start to dip, right? And then you need a great game. It doesn't make sense. One of the other things I was talking about is the salary cap and everything. And again, they were going on about why it was a good idea. And I was like, yeah, if people use the salary cap, they don't. They find there are so many easy ways to go around it. No one who follows the IPL closely believes that the salary cap is ever adhered to, right? Even when you have a situation where a team is paying well below the 100% threshold of the salary cap, they are probably still paying a player above the books who is a star on that team, right? Even in those situations, I would be shocked if there has ever been a situation where there has not been a player who has not got external money from the franchise or from someone involved in the franchise, like sponsors of the franchise, which the team has organized, right, to do that. So that's in the IPL. As you've already mentioned, the Perth Scorchers did it years ago. I wrote a big essay about it, and was given so much content by Cricket Australia because they were just sick of what was happening. Lots of leagues have done it. When I was in the CPL, the first thing I did, and I probably told this story before, but the first thing I did was I read through the entire playing conditions of the CPL and the contracts of the players. And I found about four ways to circumvent the salary cap. One of them was just really easy. I could just pay a player for promotional stuff outside of the tournament. Now, they might have changed it in the CPL. I haven't checked. But I could get around, I reckon I could get around pretty much any salary cap in world cricket. And I'm not that smart, and I'm not a lawyer, right? So salary caps in cricket are, I'm trying to think of, I know, it's like when McDonald's put the calorie stuff on their menus. It's like, yeah, I mean, no one's coming to McDonald's going, oh, I can't have this because it's like this many calories. You're going to McDonald's because you want to stuff your face and you want to taste McDonald's. Reese says, how far do we have to go with the throwback at the batter by the bowler? Arshi almost certainly aimed for Mitchell the other day. I'm not saying we'd be right, but if Mitchell got physical back, he'd get lambasted, where Arshi knows exactly what he's doing. It's always a tough one, isn't it? Because in the moment, you are throwing the ball back in frustration. I haven't seen many players ever directly throw the ball to try and hurt batters, but I have seen them do it to try and intimidate them and scare them. Do you know what? It's weird. I can't remember the Arshdeep one and even where I would fit it in. So I'm not sure that he almost certainly aimed for him, only because I'm not sure. I'm not saying he didn't. I just don't remember it enough in the line of that. But yeah, look, the Marlon Samuels one and Shane Warne's obviously really, really different, because I think we now had the great story about Shane Warne basically doing that on purpose just to try and get his team up. But we've certainly had players do that before. It's one of those things where perhaps in the future, if the batter is not out of their crease, we can get into a situation where we're like, you just get, if you throw the ball near the batter, maybe there's a fine or something involved in that. But yeah, you're right. I mean, eventually someone might come back at him. I don't think in the Daryl Mitchell case, I think they both would have been blamed, right? I'm trying to think of the one. There's one in the NBA where, God, I forget the guy. There's the two brothers, and one of them ran into Nikola Jokic, and then he like flattened him and sent him to the hospital. And it was one of those things where I think because the thing had happened before, there was an understanding of it, if not a complete acceptance of it, right? I don't even think he got done. So we had that built in, right? I mean, we had that built into laws of we understand that, you know, if someone's doing something to provoke you or physically attacking you or threatening you, you are probably going to overreact back to it. And I think it would be the same in cricket, Reese. Oh. PJ says, what's the Mendoza line for batting strike rates and bowling economy these days in T20? Or is it more complicated, position-based and changing ever to give a flat answer? So I think I'm working on a piece on this that we haven't quite got out yet, but we'll be out for the IPL. It was one of those ones of, So the Mendoza line is, I just had to make sure I was right, is from baseball, right? And it's basically the threshold between being a subpar hitter. I'm just reading this off Wikipedia now, but, so when T20 cricket started, I think the Mendoza line was probably like 116. And then it goes up and it's probably like 136 ish now. But PJ, the reason it is much tougher than baseball is because of the period in the game in which you're batting in. So I think the way that we would look at it is that you can be on a true strike rate point of view. I think you can be up to, Varun would probably disagree, but I think you can be up to about minus 10 on true strike rate. Right? Because that's a much better way of looking at it than just straight strike rate. We're not every player can be plus on true strike rate, right? Otherwise, true strike rate has no meaning anymore. And there's a bunch of players who fail, right? But about 30% of players should be above true strike rate. So you've got to allow for a bunch of players who are around par and just below par, right? And so I'd say the Mendoza line is probably more easily understood from a true strike rate point of view. And the same with the bowling one, right? But it's also more confusing because you also have how long you stay out there and then everything else. So it's not as simple, I think, as baseball, which to be fair, even baseball doesn't use those numbers anymore, right? Sinoi says, I feel like India got lucky to win the semifinal. The run out of Dubey was underreported, but given how he was going, India should have ended up at 270 minimum. Despite that, England were only 7 short, as India were probably under par. Yeah, I would kind of throw the 7 short away because you've got a 6th or 7th bowler bowling when he basically knows the game can't be lost, gets himself ahead of it, and then all the 6s come afterwards, Sinoi. So there are some games that I would say that is a genuine 7-run victory. And there are other games where I'm like, yeah. It's like, was it the Pat Cummins game in the IPL once where he hit all those runs late against Jasper Bumrah? And it's like, well, he's not going to win the game, so it kind of doesn't matter, right? We've seen Sam Curran, MS Dhoni have done that at times, right, where they suddenly go ballistic at the end when they can't win, and it looks closer than it is. I can't remember. I mean, I remember the run out, but I can't really remember exactly where they were going. I don't think they were lucky because they have Jasper Bumrah. Right. And so I didn't think there was a chance England could chase that because of Jasper Bumrah. And I knew he was going to shut down one over. And then what happens is the next over, you then get they have to overly attack it. And so he just basically takes an over out of the game and a couple of overs out of the game. Right. So I just never felt they were that close, even when they were hitting really, really well. So I probably look at it very differently than perhaps how you do. But there's luck in all these games. Right? Like, this is the thing with T20, and this is why India's record is, it just shows you how dominant they are, is a great team will win about 66% of the time in T20 cricket, right? And that's a great team. because of dew and drop catches and a freak run out and, you know, one bowler getting, you know, getting the yips or whatever it may be, just has such a bigger effect in that format than it does in any other. And so you end up in a situation where randomness comes into it a lot more. You know, test cricket, luck can play a part, but overall, you still have a chance to work your way back into most games. There's some coin tosses that maybe take that away. And some, you know, you go out and, you know, the grass is a little bit more damp or not damp or whatever, or the sun has baked the surface. There are little bits like that. But over the course of a three-test series, you still expect to the best team to come out on top more often than not, right? And certainly in a five-test series. One-day games, again, luck can play a part, but within 100 overs, you get a chance for just the better teams to sort of pull their way back into the game. T20 cricket, you know, Sikandar Raza can hit 80 off 30 balls against you, right? And then open the bowling and take three quick wickets and you lose, right? I know that didn't happen in this tournament, but I'm saying someone like Sikandar Raza can do that on his own. That, and then you drop a bunch of catches. Or three of your players make the same error on a pitch that doesn't need that really, really quickly. And there's no way to bring yourself back into some of those games. There's always luck. I can't think of a T20 World Cup where luck has not played a part at one stage in a team, either getting through or winning a crucial game or winning the final itself. I'd have to go back and have a look. Maybe there was like one really dominant game. But it's just much more luck dependent than any. And I think ODI cricket has an element of this. It's just that we come from test cricket where we don't get it as much. All right. Let us finish off the wagon wheel with some super chats. Oh, got a bunch. Arnav says, can West Indies have a revival like New Zealand? If they relayed their pitches with good batting pitches, is it financially feasible for them given their structure? Yeah, I don't think like good batting pitches is an extraordinarily expensive thing to do. Otherwise, I'm not sure New Zealand would have done it. I think it's more than just that they need to do. But yes, I do think that they can improve their cricket quite a bit by just making the pitches better for batting. I know it sounds silly, but yeah. Arnav says, heard your podcast with Hami about Pakistani players. If ECB have an issue, then don't accept money from Indian billionaires. Yeah, but these are two separate things that you're talking about here, Anna. My understanding was that the ECB had conversations and they had been told this wasn't the case. There are also Indian billionaires involved in this who are not feeling the same way. So it's not as straightforward as you're trying to make it out to be here anyway. But regardless of that being the case, the ECB has a completely different remit than the Indian billionaires, right? So once you have done that, you still have to manage it. So I'm not really sure what your point is there. Andy says, with their leagues getting private money, how long will it take for SA and England to catch up to India in terms of talent? They won't. There's still not enough money going in to it to make the difference of anywhere else. England and South Africa have very similar problems when it comes to talent. It's that the entire countries are not playing cricket at the same level as each other. And so the talent is coming from a very thin amount of people. And they're not particularly massive countries. They're medium-sized countries, but they're not massive countries. They're both, what, around 50, 60 million, maybe 60, 70 million. You can't compare that to some of the other bigger countries who play cricket, like, you know, Bangladesh and Pakistan and obviously India. So, yeah, you have other natural advantages. The English and South African school systems are incredible. But that's still a small percentage of people who are ending up at those schools. And so eventually, you're not going to get all your talent. And I don't think there's enough money coming into these other leagues to change that. Now, maybe if it was run... But this is the issue, that I just don't think those leagues are ever going to be big enough to do it. I suppose the best way would be if you got... But once you have an auction or even a draft system, maybe if it was a draft system in the IPL, that would actually be the best case scenario for these kinds of things, Andy. Because if you had, and weirdly, the Acquired podcast talked about how the auction is better than a draft, but this is a perfect case of if you really want there to be more, if you really want people to find hidden talent, it probably makes more sense in a draft system than it does in an auction system. But also, I think the scouting networks are still a little bit all linked to each other anyway. Samrat says, India's victory reminded me of the Australian women in 2020 win. Home World Cup, a defeat to start, and then a thrashing in the finals in front of a record. Do you think this India is comparable to the Australian women's team in terms of aura? No, I mean, that was just a team that... I mean, that's a team that has dominated for so long over multiple generations, right? You know, we did this with the Indian men's test team. That incredible run that they've had that just finished with losing to New Zealand. And we did a video going, the big difference between what they did and what the West Indies did is that West Indies obviously were better away from home, but also that the West Indies did it with a generational reload, whereas Australia and India did not. It was basically around two key bowlers. And once that one of those bowlers slipped or left the team, things changed quite quickly. Whereas the West Indies did something very different. Look at the Australian women's team. It's completely reloaded itself maybe three times. And it doesn't seem to matter, right? Up until really recently, it was just dominant for a huge amount of time. So, no, I don't really have them as comparable in that. Brian Lara used pot plants to work on his placement. John Wright glued his glove to his bat. Sachin Tendulkar dug up practice pitches. Tatenda Taibu cut the top off his bat. Claire Taylor used a hockey grip. Steve Smith was from tennis. Dean Jones would call phantom runs. And Victor Trumper turned the Nets into a war zone to survive. The best batters in the world do whatever they have to make runs. We have told their stories in our new book, The Art of Batting. Blue Eagle says, with England's white ball decline, is a lot of it down to them being worse than India, Australia, and South Africa, who applied their brand of cricket to better talent? Yes, I do think there is an element of that. I would give you that. I think one of India's big problems before was they had guys who could absolutely smash everything out of the park, and they were purposely being within themselves, right? The old, you know, Rohit, Virat, Shikhar Dhawan opening partnership was just like, why would you? You could get anyone to do this. These guys can score way quicker. And so, yeah, I think teams waking up to that. I also think it's that England was always really one-sided on the ball, right? It was all batting, and the bowling just had to hang in there and be handy, right? So if you put in Jofra, Plunkett, Adil, with little bits of Mark Wood, I suppose, when he was around, and all the all-rounders, it wasn't a fan. I don't think it was ever a great bowling attack, but it was good enough if they were outscoring everyone consistently. They've stopped outscoring everyone consistently. And some of that is also that the next generation hasn't come through. That was a magical generation that England had that they ruined for years. They didn't even pick half of them at that to begin with. But that sort of pro 40, you know, that sort of pro 40 side of things is, you know, that whole generation of guys who came through that, they've also disappeared. And I do think, and Tom Banton's a perfect example of this, I think Tom Banton is everything that's wrong with English cricket and also what might eventually be right about English cricket. Whereas I think Tom Banton was one of those guys, if you bowl right arm seam to him, he would just club you out of the ground again and again and again. And the minute he got exposed at the other level, he didn't have the ability to hit other bowling as consistently. And then people worked out how to bowl better to him as a right, you know, with right arm seam as well. And so I think there was this massive sort of swing back. I think England has produced a lot of guys like Tom Banton. And I didn't get a chance to write a piece on him this tournament, but I'm hoping he plays in the IPL or I get to cover him again soon. Because what he's done to fill out his game is, I really think, one of the big issues with all English cricket. They are so good at ball machines and throwdowns and right arm seam. And I think if you look at the other teams around the world, we are seeing far more varied and interesting hitters coming through the game in those other countries. You know, how fascinating is it that Heinrich Klassen came from South Africa? You know, just that's really, really interesting to me going ahead. RM says, Akib Nabi and Akash Deep's wobble ball cleaned up Ranji batting. Grimy of Bengal, front foot triggers and back foot use scored 164. Still, solution? He might just be better set up for the kind of delivery that they're bowling. It could have just been, if he just scored 146, it could be a wicket where the ball wasn't seaming as much. The ball could have gone flatter. It could be a solution, but I'd have to watch it to actually have seen it. I'd be shocked if some random guy, and not that he's random, but you know what I mean? Like if Kane Williamson and Virat couldn't work it out and some other guy just has. Like, not to say that there isn't a movement towards people should be working it out slightly better as things go. But you know what I mean? Like, it just seems like a bit of a weird pull, all things considered. Samit says, how excited are you for Australia versus South African test? 8 years after the 18 tour. How excited am I for it? I suppose it's a long way off still, isn't it? It feels like now we've got the Women's World Cup. We've got little series that are cool, but feels like there's a bit of a lull between the IPL and you've got the IPL, Women's World Cup, and it's a bit of a down year. And then we get to this series at the end. I'm happy it's happening. I think these are very different teams, though. Like, look at the names that you're mentioning here. You know, QDK won't be playing, Warner won't be playing, Faf won't be playing, Lyon may not be playing. Mornay won't be playing. Will Pat Cummins be always fit? I think with that there's quite a bit of change. So I'm excited for it because I think that they're the two best test teams in the world right at the moment. So I think that's cool, but I'm not massively like, and it's miles away. I get excited about things when they're like, literally have already started. Smeed says Australia, follow on, Australia, South Africa test in Durban and Burka. After the India tour, I joke South Africa should roll out spinning desks versus Australia and England. But could we actually see Maharaj, Mutsuswami as a spin trio? Never thought I'd see South Africa play three spinners. I've been saying this for ages. The wickets have changed there, man. It was always a potentiality that we would see this. A lot of it probably depends on Lyon. I don't think you want to make it too spin dependent if it's Lyon. You also, the one thing that Australia is kind of, you don't want to make it like a ragging spin pitch, do you? You want to make it a swim pitch that you still need a lot of skill on, because then you've got Maharaj and Harmer. You don't want to make it a ragger when Australia can then go, okay, well, we'll just bring Kuhneman just in case, right? And then they have multiple options. I do think it's very clear that South African wickets have been changing over a long, slow process. Magesh says, are sports journos informed enough to opine on the impact of geopolitics holistically on sports these days? I think you're assuming there that they were in the old days. Look, it depends. Every sports writer is different. There are, you know, I've been writing about sports politics and business for a very long time, right? So I probably started covering it in 2009. Partly because I noticed that other cricket writers weren't covering it. So learning about these sorts of things is part of, I've shared this conversation before, but me and Jonathan Liu once had a chat about sports writing. And one of the things we both like about it is sport touches everything. So in order to write about sport, you actually have to learn about drugs, billionaires, gambling, mafia at times, geopolitics, trans rights. I could go on and on. Like, it really, when you're doing, I learn about ADHD writing about cricketers with ADHD, right? So it's a it from that point of view, that's kind of what you have to do. But that's kind of what journalists do in general, Magesh. They go off and they learn about a topic because they've got to write a piece on it, especially the kind of journalist that I am, you know, which is more a long form feature type. That's kind of what you do because you can't be an expert on all these different things. You go off and you learn about it. And then you try and cover it as best as possible. So I don't think geopolitics is anything different than trying to learn about estrogen levels, right? Trying to learn about PEDs or trying to learn about the science of DRS, right? These are complicated issues, man. And, you know, look at, you look at someone like Henry Abbott on the True Hoops website, and he is covering sport and also Epstein because that has kind of overlapped with NBA owners. And so he's done some of the best work on Epstein, and he's a basketball writer. Now, I don't know that much about Henry Abbott. Like, I met him very briefly at Sloan a couple of years ago and have followed his work and read his articles. But like, his last book was about player injury management, right? Like, I've got it here somewhere. We were supposed to do a podcast together, but we kind of fell out of touch. But so he's someone who writes about basketball and basketball analytics and analysis and all these really, really cool things. And he writes about Epstein and billionaires. And he writes about how your hips are aligned. That's what sport is. Now, there are lots of people who don't know anything about sporting history or geopolitical history who will still weigh in on it. But you'll get that in any, you know, you won't get, that's absolutely no different than the same people online who are moaning about things you don't understand about them as well. Like, that's just life. Andy says, salary cap in the IPL, doesn't the auction ensure that you still have to assemble your entire squad barring four players within salary constraints? Doesn't the auction ensure that you still have to assemble your entire squad barring four players within salary cap constraints? I'm not really sure what you're asking here. Sorry, I don't understand the question. Uday says, hi, Jared, off topic. You can't be off topic on a Wagger Wheel show, right? You can be off topic on a match video. You cannot be off topic on this. I finally managed to read The Art of Batting. I was going to lift it up, and I've got my laptop on it, so I can't. Wait a minute. Maybe he can. Maybe I can. What? This Art of Batting? That wasn't really worth it, was it? I finally managed to read The Art of Batting. Absolutely loved it. Making my own top 50 now. Oh, awesome. A few people have told me they have, and I've seen, you know, some of them have sent them through, and there's been some wild sort of different reasoning, and that's kind of one of the things I wanted to do. I never wanted it to be like a list from God. I know there were some people that were like really upset. And they were like, you know, he's got this person here. And I'm like, yeah, but that's because this is the way that we came to it. If you come to it from your perspective, I can definitely see how you would change it, right? Like, that's a respectable way of doing it. I didn't think I was writing it on stone tablets to be put up somewhere forever. So yeah, no, have fun with it. You never know. Could be a bowling version one day. Rohit says, an Indian owner would easily make a point for not picking Pakistan players on skill alone, only Tariq exception. 100 auction will create controversy no matter what. No, there are plenty. I mean, have you watched the 100? There are plenty of Pakistani players who are good enough to play in the 100. Like, there's at least 8, right? And not to mention that we just had Babar Azam, who's not even good enough, and he was playing in the Big Bash, but they're not making it on skill, Rohit. So, you know, that was the old Lalit Modi one, right? Of like, there aren't any Pakistani players good enough to play in the IPL. And so Sohail Tanvir's like, dude, what? So, I mean, no. As I said, again, they don't make that claim. Anyway, they don't really speak about it publicly all that much. The other issue for just on that, by the way, which is kind of separate, is if it becomes Bangladesh as well, right, and then it starts to spread into other countries, that makes it just harder and harder for those other leagues to to deal with these ownership groups. But again, I said all this would happen, I said this happened when Hampshire was bought and Muhammad Abbas left. Right? He's the best bowler in county cricket. Left his team. Zara says, chances of Durban hoping a semi-final. Ooh. So Cape Town and the Wanderers are going to get one. So who had the semi-finals last time? God, where was I? I was at them. This is going back to 2003. Where on earth was I? I think it was Centurion, wasn't it? So I would have thought that those three and then Durban. It's also based on hotels and stuff. I think Durban has pretty good hotels, but Centurion obviously being close to Johannesburg. So Centurion is a great stadium. And I, from my usage of both of them as a fan and media, I would say it's a better stadium than Durban. And it also allows people to stay in Joburg and in, you know, Pretoria to go to the game, which probably ships it out a little bit. I would say, though, that Durban's probably got a lot of hotels. And certainly my memory of Durban is a lot of hotels. But yeah, I don't know what the actual dynamics of that would be. It's a very good question. Where are we here? Anav says, you're correct that it is not as straightforward, but there is a pattern across sports where they take money from Saudis and then do moral outrage. I think he's talking about England and football. Yeah, but don't you're that's a very different thing than what happened with the ECB, right? Because what you're talking about here is that football fans in general and you know, fans in general were like, we shouldn't be taking money from the Saudis, but then one particular or a couple of football, I don't know how many, but one major football club that I'm aware of took the money, right? And then that became a separate issue. This is very, very different. That football club is not trying to run the entire country. They are then owned, right, outright. That's not even, these aren't even being owned outright. Also, the 100 is a competition that has been pushed to be inclusive. Again, not what football is doing. Football is a very different kind of sport. I agree with the very general, and I talked about this when the Saudis first came in, of, you know, I when it comes down to it, most things that happen in sport are sports washing, right? And I said that at the same time with the Saudis, with everything else. There's a reason why England spread cricket around the world, right? They were trying to do their values. And it wasn't even their good values. It was their terrible values. It was their class system values. So there is an element of that all the way through. And I think that should be called out. But also should be called out when people aren't willing to come forward and say things publicly, right? More, these Indian billionaires want to come in and own a team in the UK, which is an inclusive league, which is trying to push to everyone in the UK. They should then also be saying, right, okay, here are our cards on the table. I think that's a more than fair thing to do. I think there's been a lot of things that have been done in cricket over the last couple of years that no one ever says officially, and we all know are true, right? And it's time for us to call a lot of that out. And it, you know, that's hopefully where we're heading. Yash. Oh, God, Yash. So many questions today. Where is Yash? Oh, now I got it here. Jared, as test skipper, what would you pick an all-rounder with 35 average at 7 and 40 average bowling, or a bowling average of 27 with a batting average of 20? Well, 35 average at 7 is pretty high. So what is going to help me win the game a lot more? I say neither of those really help me as much as you probably think they do. Because if the batter is at number 7, they're not actually in the top 6. And I still need a really, really good wicketkeeper batter to make that work as an all-rounder. So if I have a really good wicketkeeper batter, then I would pick that option. But someone bowling an average of 40 probably is a stock bowler and a defensive option rather than anything else. A bowling average of 27 with a batting average of 20 is really not an all-rounder at all. they're just helping you to be have a stronger number eight. So again, I would need to know what the rest of that lineup would be in order for it to work, right? I can't just make the that call until knowing what the full team is. Jack says, can any of the elite test batting and bowling skills help in T20s? Could Kohli have played that crazy shot at the MCG if he weren't a test player? Theoretically, is there an equivalent of that in bowling? Yeah, there's heaps. I mean, we just talked about Tom Banton. He went back to first class cricket to become better at T20 cricket. Especially when you get to the top levels and you're facing Trent Bolt and he's swinging the ball in with his pace and his skill and everything else, you want to be someone who's faced more than just five or six balls that are swinging at the start of a T20 game. Absolutely plenty of skills that come across. And I think that's one of the more interesting things going ahead is test cricket may not be the major form of cricket, but it might be still one of the best places to make the best players even better. Even Andre Russell played first class cricket, right? Like Chris Gayle was a, you know, definitely a well above average test player as well. Abe says, what makes Bethel such a good all-format player? Look, at the moment, he's been absolutely brilliant, mostly on flatter wickets, where he sees the ball really early and has multiple scoring options available to him. He hasn't even developed yet, so we don't even know where he's going to develop and how he's going to develop. But yeah, I'm not sure he is such an all-format player at the moment, but he's just a guy who sees the ball really early. We've got a long time before, you know, he's not an all-format player right now. He's a player who probably sees the ball and hits the ball at the moment, and that works in all three formats, but a long way to go. Zah says, what is this, in 2023? It was at Kingsmead and St. George's. Actually, it might have been St. George's. You might be right. So they're probably not getting one. So then Kingsmead is a chance. I don't remember. I was at the game, but I can't remember. I remember it raining at the one I was at. Soham says, what irks Indian fans is that journos talk about India-Pakistan issues as if they exist in a silo. Never see them even acknowledge terror attacks, even though England experience it firsthand in OA feels dismissive. Yeah, I think that's nonsense. Soham, sorry. What irks Pakistani fans is that cricket journalists don't talk enough about the issues that Pakistan has to go through because of India as well. Believe it or not, Indian fans and Pakistan fans are both going to be upset by this because it's a politically divisive issue. Everyone is going to find something to be upset about with this. It's a wedge issue. That's how wedge issues work. So, yeah, you can find something. I can find five more things on the other side, right? Been doing this for 19 years, right? I can tell you I've had every single argument given to me all the time. Vimal says, bro, I know you won't like this, but if your countrymen had been killed in terrorist attacks originating from that country, you'd say, okay, ban in England. Well, my country has had terrorist attacks by people from different countries. So I don't really, again, it's just, thanks for giving me the money, but it's just nonsense. Uday says, where would you rank Bumrah in the best test bowlers of all time overall? For me, the best after McGrath in fast bowls and top four in bowlers after Warne and Murali. Where would you rank Bumrah in the best bowlers of all time? Yeah, I think he's already got a case to be top 10 pretty solidly. It's how far you sort of bring that down and how you weight different formats as well. I think we've looked at this before. His one day is not quite as exceptional as his T20 and his test. The other guys only had to play in two formats, certainly in their peaks anyway. I'm trying to think of anyone else. I think Imran and Malcolm Marshall sort of slip off. Garner obviously comes back into that conversation as well. Am I missing anyone else? I don't think Lily Hadley and Imran are probably all just slightly. I'm not sure the Bumrah hasn't got past them all as all format. But yeah. Zara says, top three cricket bats. Also thoughts on non-bat makers like MRS sponsoring top players and brandishing their stickers or bats. Weirdly, I'm writing about that at the moment because I'm writing about Virat. I'm not sure that matters all that much. I think that the ICC and MCC tried to do the right thing. But ultimately, like, all they have to do is buy. Like, by the way, MRF was not the first company to do this, which I only found out in my research. Puma was the first company to do this. Puma bought Millichamp and Hall, and it was a bit of a partnership. But my understanding is that Puma was the first company to do this. And if there's another company before them, I haven't found them yet. So we've got what? Seat, Nike, Puma, Reebok, MRF, obviously the kings of it. But I'm trying to think if there's any others. I love the Nike bat. So like, I think it would be disingenuous to say that, like, and I love the Puma bat. So like, why is it okay for them? Because they're more in sports than MRF. But MRF have actually done some pretty cool things for cricket with the Pace Academy and everything, right? So I don't know. I feel maybe a little bit conflicted. Top three bats of all time. The Scoop is the greatest bat of all time. And the distance between the Scoop and the second best bat is monumental in my mind. I probably love the V100 would be up there as well. And I'm missing something really obvious. I might go the old Puma Millichamp Hall before it became Puma Puma. I might go one of those as well. Karen says, thoughts on Gary Kirsten as the Sri Lanka coach? That's a really good question. I just feel like it will end badly. But I don't think he's a bad person for that job. I think we're starting to get to this point, though, where like Gary Kirsten, Mickey Arthur, Jamie Siddons, Stuart Law are just like, they're just rotating around jobs over and over again. And so I wonder if we're in a situation now where we just have international coaches and franchise coaches. And because of that, there actually aren't that many coaches to pick from at the international level. That's not having a go at Gary Kirsten and not even saying he would be bad at the job, but just, it just feels like every time I get a press release, it's the same name over and over again. Right. So that would be my biggest issue. Key differences between Dravid and Calton Gambier as coaches. They're just they're very different human beings. Right. So forget as coaches, they're just very different human beings. I think they see the role differently. I think they, have a different understanding of cricket. They have a different way of discussing things. They couldn't be any more different. Amateur cricketer says, what's your preferred choice of platforms for analyzing players, comparisons between teams, and more as an expert in the game? I don't know how to answer that, amateur cricketer. What's your preferred choice of platforms for analyzing players, comparisons between teams, and more as expert in the game? Combox? I mean, we take stuff from everywhere, really. I don't know if we have like a preferred place that we go to. Vimo says, geez, why so dismissive? I can't even remember what you asked now, mate. Sorry. Do you really not see how the Pakistan government is responsible for this situation? Well, the Pakistan government isn't responsible for the situation, right? People want to talk about geopolitics. The English government is responsible for the situation, right? England as a nation came in and ruined so many countries around the world. India should continue to play cricket like nothing happened. Well, they did because they played them in the World Cup. So India did continue to play cricket like nothing happened, Vimal. Shresh says, India's political environment has fundamentally changed. Reasonable conversations impossible. North and South Korea have combined sports teams. Did they? That's a good one. I do not know about that at all, Shresh. Look, once you get politics involved, you can tell by Vimal being upset and by other people being upset. That's what I mean. There is no way of doing this because it's hard enough to talk about whether Bumrah should be a top 10 bowler of all time, right? Now you're putting in the media that you follow, the algorithms that you follow in these day and age, your understanding of history, what your parents have told you. I've never met two people who've ever actually agreed on politics in my entire life. And I've been all around the world, right? As I just said, he said, Pakistan is to blame. It's like, well, I mean, it all comes back to what actually happened when a big country came in and tried to steal resources from other countries and then decided to put up borders and to be involved with all these different things and separate people and blah, 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 right? These things have been going on for a long time. But I want to know a lot more about North and South Korea having combined sports teams. Anav says, has Gigi proven he gets T20 better than anyone? No. I didn't. There was nothing in this tournament that made me think he was like a soothsayer from the future. He had the best team. If Gary Kirsten had this team, I think they still would have won the World Cup. Name your least favorite coach, and I think they would still have a pretty good chance of winning the World Cup with this. So no, I wasn't sitting there thinking that there was tactical genius. They had the best team on paper by an absolutely country mile. They could actually, it's a bit like some of the old Australian teams where tactically sometimes you'd be like, why would they do that? And it's like, but it won't matter. They're going to win anyway, right? Like, I think there is an element of that as well. But I do think he's a much better white ball coach than he is a red ball coach. So he's proven that he gets white T20 cricket better than he gets test cricket as a coach so far, but he's also very new into test cricket, right? Like as a coach, like he'd been working around white ball teams and franchises for quite a while. So very, very different from that perspective. Someone else is going to come. Shresh says the 2018 Winter Olympics. Well, Shresh, that is fascinating. I really like, actually, I think it's one of the more fascinating things in the world is teams made up of multiple countries. And I think it's one of the things I like about, cricket in general is that we've had so many of those come up over and over again, right? So yeah. Vimal says he's not upset, just don't like being dismissed. Mate, it's a show where I've had to answer about 150 questions. Some of them just get dismissed. Some of them get short answers. Some of them are going to annoy me. If you don't want that to happen, don't ask the questions. I mean, that's just how it's going to be, my man. That wagon wheel has never changed. I remember early on in wagon wheel, I got this message from someone saying, you were very rude and I'm no longer going to support you. And I went back and looked at their question and their question was rude, right? Like sometimes if you're going to bring up political stuff on here, right? Probably not going to answer it or be happy with you. Because here's the thing, Vimal, we probably don't agree on politics, right? But you're going to be a lot more upset about politics than you are about if I say, oh, I don't know if Sachin was the same as Brian Lara because of this, this, and this, right? And those people are still sending me emails, right? If you don't want to hear my political opinions on things, you don't have to ask me questions about it, and you certainly don't have to follow me, right? I would never make anyone follow me. But as I said, I've been working in this for a very, very long time. I get asked these questions. I'm happy to answer them. If you don't like the way I answer them, don't ask them in the future. Anyway, thank you to everyone who supported me on this show and on all the shows. I know we've got so many super chats today for a wagon wheel. So thank you. The YouTube thing was out there. Thanks to Shrest, I'm going to be off trying to find this North Korea, South Korea Winter Olympics team because I'm now fascinated. But thanks to everyone. We'll be back soon. We've got a bunch of crick picks, which I think we recorded. Because Bayram got obsessed with crick picks before the World Cup and made us record like 10 episodes. And I kept saying, but during the World Cup, we're not even going to put out any crick picks. We're going to have so much content. So we've got a bunch of crick picks to come and some other stuff on the main channel. We probably will have a bit more of a down week on the main channel now. Everyone needs a bit of a rest and refresh, but we've got plenty of content that we'll be working on very soon. And thank you to everyone. And we'll see you again very soon here on Combox and on Good Aerial. Thank you for listening to this podcast on the Combox Network. There is an ad-free version of this you can find by supporting us on Patreon at Good Areas Podcast. You can also access our Discord channel there. Please like, subscribe, and rate this show. Every one of these helps us. If there was a guest on a show, you can find their links in the show notes. Huge thanks to Rukshit, Ishit, and everyone else who helps us get our content out there. If you want to know more about us, head to combox.tv. If you make a lot of content like me, oh, you are going to need help. And that is why we use Minvo.pro, a slicing and dicing tool that uses AI to conjure up incredible clips from your podcasts and meetings. If you make content, go to Minvo.pro to cut it.